this week. The U.S. equities exploded higher ahead of the holiday weekend. The Dow added over 300 points for the week. Well, welcome to Gold Seek Radio, everyone. Chris Waltzek here again with you on this long Memorial Day holiday weekend. Gerald Celente joins me from the Trends Research Institute. He outlines a bullish case for the yellow metal. Like many of our guests, he thinks gold is destined to cross 1400 on the way to 2000. He's also concerned by the housing bubble part two, which might burst in even more spectacular fashion than 2007 due to greater government intervention. He outlines the case for the bubble bursting as well as QE3, QE squared, QE cubed, exponential to infinity. Next at bat, Bob Hoy, senior investment strategist at Institutional Advisors, makes investing entertaining. He says a new cyclical bull market could be unfolding right before our eyes in the precious metals sector, and with the XAU still higher from its lows by over 100% in just a few months, maybe he's onto something. Then, our latest listeners Q&A segment includes four callers, including Mark from Northern Idaho, one very enthusiastic Gold Seek Radio listener, longtime listener George, and John from San Diego, with all kinds of interesting questions and comments. Robert Ian wraps up the show with another must-hear editorial. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Partly cloudy skies continued to hover over the precious metal sector this week for the fourth week running. The yellow metal found support, though, above 1200, giving back only 37, about 3%. Silver gave back only 30 cents, less than 2%, closing at 1625, while the precious metals XAU shares index recoiled 7%, dropping 6 points and finishing at 79. However, the shares are still higher, as I mentioned, by over 100% from the year's low, which was under 40, as strong bullion prices tends to boost mining companies, earnings, and demand remain strong. Well, with $8.1 trillion of global government bonds yielding negative interest rates, investors poured $9 billion into gold-backed ETFs this year, the most of all the exchange-traded funds, with net inflows of $18 billion in 2016, compared to only about $800 million in equity funds. So you're talking way over 20 times more into gold. In the first quarter, about 1,100 fund managers, including billionaire George Soros, bought more than 78 million shares of Barrick Gold, the world's biggest producer. Gold has recorded its best showing in a decade, while the value of more than 10 major mining companies has doubled so far this year. And hedge fund legend Stanley Druckenmiller fancies gold on the heels of record QE in Japan, EU, and the U.S. Several of his colleagues agree, noting negative interest rates are a non sequitur, at least with gold and silver investors. You don't have to pay interest when you invest, unlike bonds, which punish savers. The move by Soros and others to own Barrick includes a nice dividend. Goldman Sachs Group's equity research team recommends buying Newmont and Barrick, saying it expects both the miners to benefit from margin expansion. And Druckenmiller bought 2 million shares of Barrick, roughly, ticker ABX, which is up over 100% this year, while Einhorn Greenlight Capital nearly doubled its exposure to the precious metal sector, up to $173 million. The California State Teachers Retirement System added to its holdings of Newmont Mining, that's ticker NEM, while Tudor Investment added shares of Randgold Resources and Royal Gold, ticker RGLD. However, I think it's important to note here that the prices are correcting. They do still appear somewhat overextended on the upside and overbought. And according to, I think, almost anyone who can look at a chart, as well as Samir Samana at the St. Louis-based Global Quantitative Strategist Department at Wells Fargo, they oversee $1.6 trillion. They're overextended. And I think I agree with this. The commodities and precious metals, though, will likely experience years of volatility, building a big base for the next bull market. Precious metals, bottom line. The precious metals are approaching a 50% correction here in the past month. As long as support holds and the dollar rally fizzles and this rate hike scare passes, I think new highs could still unfold for the year. Even if the Fed pulls the trigger on a rate hike in July, I think it's unlikely that the bear market will resume. Visibility virtually unlimited over the New York Stock Exchange this week as huge capital flows continued to pour into the U.S. markets in search of those relatively higher returns in the U.S. Nations like Japan and EU offering negative interest rates, which makes our S&P with its solid dividend much more enticing. Ahead of the long Memorial Day holiday, the Dow added 372 points, over 2%, finishing at 17,873 for the week. The S&P 500 picked up 46, about 2.25, closing just below 2,100, while the NASDAQ added 164, stealing the show, a 3.5% gain, and closing at the highest point of the year so far. West Texas Intermediate crude added over a dollar, finishing with an earshot of $50 a barrel. This was a commodity under 30 not too long ago, and the best close in over a year. Well, a top story driving the equities prices higher continues to be robust economic conditions, at least from the standpoint of Fed policymakers. The current Fed funds futures odds indicates virtually next to no odds for June, but a much stronger chance in July. Bottom line on Wall Street. Well, although market volatility, as viewed by the CBOT VIX, is tame, the fear and greed index did reach the extremely greedy levels, suggesting that there were starting to see some serious frothiness in the markets. Now that the typical holiday end-of-month rally has passed, I continue to look for better buying opportunities later in the summer months. Coming up after the break, more Gold Seek Radio. We'd like for you to stay with us right here. Opening up the digital phone lines for listeners' questions and comments.
Hi, Chris. Mark, listening to you in lovely northern Idaho. I'm curious what your thoughts are on bullion as a tax haven. Obviously, it's working out well for me so far, but I'm curious what your overall thoughts of, you know, from your perspective would be. I sold a lot of stocks last year, and I just got clobbered in taxes. And I have a lot of bullion, but I'm always thinking about that from both an inheritance tax point of view, you know, selling, what kind of things should we be aware of, and what should we be watching out for when they want to come and get it. So, love the show. Thank you. Bye.
Mark from Northern Idaho paid Uncle Sam some big fees after selling his stocks and U.S. shares. He's curious if he'll face similar issues with his gold investments. Well, hi, Mark. You know, obviously, I'm a bit biased towards the yellow metal. I can really make a case for the precious metals and their tax benefits. My best advice is always diversification. I mean, few if any professionals really beat a diversified, balanced market on a regular basis. And I'm also not an advocate of owning any single asset class unless you are a professional full-time investor. And even then, I would say I think there's an important proviso, and that is diversification among even professional investments and professionals is ideal. If you read Jack Swagger's books, his latest was on hedge fund managers. He interviews really the world's best investors of all time. Every one of his books I have in my library, and I highly recommend everything he's written. Many of the top pros that you listen to in the hedge fund industry trade against their big positions, meaning that if they're going to trade, they're going to have a large position going in the other direction. You know, their risk is minimized, or they will trade against a big portfolio, diversified portfolio. So just like putting your safety belt in your car, you know, it may be boring. It could save you. On to tax implications. I like to think of the tax implications on your precious metals as the premium on an auto or home renter's insurance, because those costly premium payments are similar to a tax, although not always compulsory in every case. So imagine paying your mortgage for, let's say, 20 years. Then due to economic conditions or whatnot, you lapse on the home insurance and the house burns down. 20 years are wiped away from equity saved, lost, gone. Well, similarly, gold and silver are that insurance policy. So I think any tax implications are irrelevant. You don't think twice about paying a small monthly homeowner's insurance fee, and very few homes burn down. But when it does, it's must have. You need it. Accidents happen. It happens to the best of folks, and having that insurance is there. I suggest, again, if you're not a professional, putting aside no more than 1% of your wealth for that activity and putting the rest in rock-solid bullion and a portfolio of diversified assets, ideally under the management of a professional. Now, let me give an example and some ideas here. If you haven't already run into Dr. Nicholas Nassim Taleb and his work, you know, A Black Swan, Fame Fooled by Randomness, Fragility, I believe is one of his latest big bestsellers, a bevy of his interviews on YouTube, reading his work, understanding that he watched most of his colleagues implode at Goldman Sachs and his tenure there. If I could encapsulate his wisdom, or some of the wisdom, theme that runs through his books, is that we are hardwired to essentially ignore the risks. We don't view risk in a truly reasonable fashion. We tend to see it as linear, but risks are really more parabolic and hyperbolic in nature. And in other words, they shoot up exponentially and then drop off hyperbolically. We have a tendency to underestimate our likelihood of making a mistake. And eventually, because of underestimation and overconfidence, or, you know, personal hubris, the overwhelming majority of accounts implode. I mean, you really want to study these folks. If you're going to trade, you trade with a tiny amount of money. You take enormous bets against sectors with very, very, he likes out of the money puts and calls. So a sector that's just gone bananas, like maybe the VIX or VVIX indexes, and they shoot up to some record like 50 or 60 on the VIX, he would say, well, I'm going to go with a bunch of out-of-the-money puts. And then, of course, as it returns to the mean, as volatility always does, he will reap a handsome benefit. Of course, sometimes he makes 100 or 1,000-fold, as has Arch Crawford. Now, Arch Crawford's strategy is a little different. He'll take $1,000 a month when the markets are ripping to the upside and just short each month, 1,000, 1,000, 1,000. And eventually, one time, he cleared somewhere around $250,000 on a $5,000 or $10,000 investment doing that. So the point is if you can take a modicum of your income or of your total wealth, tiny amounts, and the rest is just put away and managed. Okay, and by the way, congratulations on your successful endeavor in the precious metals market. You're obviously starting at the beginning of one of the best rallies in decades.
Chris, I talk too much. But anyhow, I just wanted to call you because I'm actually on your YouTube channel and I was searching for Martin Armstrong because I love him. And just saw that the latest thing that he had offered was on your channel, New Year's Eve. Normally, I don't subscribe because I don't like, you know, a whole bunch of inundation on my channel because I try to focus. I heard your message on the New Year's resolution, and I don't know if you're a vegan or a vegetarian, but I'm a baby stacker, been since the 08 Ron Paul revolution, and I'm so thrilled to hear of a brother in arms. You made my morning. I have shared your video. I subscribed instantly. Ignore the haters. The only way we can financially really move forward is if we can get rid of spending a lake's worth of dang money feeding a cow when we have these alternatives. I am so excited. I am so happy to hear that I'm not alone. I hope this gets to you well. It's foreboding what's coming up. We have the revolution at hand. Just lead by example. Keep doing what you're doing. I appreciate you sticking your neck out. Oh, you made my morning. Thank you. Thank you so much. Have a great day. Thank you so much.
Next up, a very enthusiastic caller likes Martin Armstrong and appreciates our work here at Gold Seek Radio. Well, caller, thanks for the kind words, and I really like your energy level and enthusiasm. I even would be so humble as to suggest starting your own podcast on blogger.com. With that level of energy, it sounds to me like other folks might appreciate your thoughts as well. Moving on, longtime listener and regular caller, George.
Hello, Chris. This is George. I want to ask a question. I think if 7 years of 0% interest rate policy, Q1, QE2, Operation Twist, then QE3, which the pundits originally said were emergency temporary measures, not debt monetization, failed to produce an economic expansion, and only created malinvestments and bubbles. Why would further extreme adjustments in monetary policy producing negative interest rates and outright monetization of ETFs and other instruments help growth and capital investment? This is being tested in Europe and Japan, so we will see. I just do not understand why these pseudo-Keynesians think the extension of failed monetary policies and central bank intervention that is unprecedented in history will work. Thank you very much.
Hi, George. You know, ditto those sentiments. Unfortunately for us, I think most Keynesian and monetarist policies are akin to King Canute. You'll recall the fabled royalty who was so full of hubris he was convinced he could command the tides. Which, this is actually historically incorrect. It's now become a cliche for overconfidence. And in similar fashion, I think our economic policies are attempting to command the economic tides using some faulty methods. In principle, these monetary methods could have worked if and only if they were merely emergency methods, as you mentioned, and as they were first proposed. You simply cannot keep the life support running forever without some serious long-term implications and complications. And I think, unfortunately, that's where our global system appears to be at this point. Simply put, the schoolteacher, I think, has fed the students sugary treats before the game of musical chairs, which kept the festivities going much longer than typical, but eventually everyone tires out and requires a rest. And that rest might be 2 or 3 hours, which might be what she was looking for. For my conspiracy theorist, you can draw your own conclusions from that last sentence. Could this collapse be contrived, and is that the goal of the powers that be? That's up to you to decide. When that day of reckoning comes, though, I think we have several recent examples to draw parallels, such as Venezuela, where the price of a loaf of bread is nearly 10 times higher than it was a year or two ago. Can't imagine trying to feed my family as, you know, the unemployment soars 30, 40, 50% and prices soar 5-10 fold. You know, this is stagflation on steroids. It's just a worst of worlds scenario. We haven't seen anything quite like that in this land since our Civil War. Could it come here? Well, the answer to that is anything is possible. So again, caller, thanks. Great question and comments.
John from sunny San Diego. Just a little commentary on Armstrong's comment about the stock market, how it's not in a bubble because there's no retail participation. Well, did Mr. Armstrong ever consider that maybe the baby boomer generation, after having been burned twice by the stock market, most of them have migrated to the bond market, in particular bond mutual funds, hence the huge bubble in the bond market, of course precipitated by the Federal Reserve and other central banks, and that this time it really is different. Price-earnings ratios are off the charts. Most of the trades are being conducted by robo-traders, and those algos will turn a dime once they're unable to stop the inevitable collapse of stock prices. Instead of buying the dips, they'll be selling the rip. So anyway, Armstrong's an interesting character, but I don't think he's got this one quite right. He claims to have an infallible computer programs that predict every single thing in the world, including when you're going to pass gas. I ain't buying it, okay? Like I said, Armstrong's an interesting character, especially his comments that hyperinflation doesn't exist. Well, how does he explain Argentina, Zimbabwe, Weimar Germany? Oh, I know he tried to explain Weimar Germany in that interview, but I think he's missing the forest for the trees. It'll be interesting to see how this all turns out. Keep up the good work.
Last but not least, John from San Diego. He says that baby boomers' retirements were crushed twice by the stock bubbles and busts of 2000-2008, so they turned to the bond market, which could be an enormous bubble as well. John, you know, just think where those trillions of dollars will eventually flow from the bond and stock bubbles, for that matter, when we hear that popping sound. We'd like to field your questions and comments. You can just send a message if you like to gsr@hughes.net. You can call into our hotline. That's 1-206-6665-370. We'd like for you to jot it down on a Post-it pad or plug it right into your phone. 1-206-6665-370. More Gold Seek after this. The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the 8th largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves, industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank, and founding director. Their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Ria project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
It's a pleasure to welcome Bob Hoy, the institutional advisor. Welcome back.
Hi, Chris. Good to be with you.
Great to have you back today. And, you know, a lot going on in the markets. Best aspects of this chosen path is that there's always something interesting brewing somewhere. Why don't I just give you the floor and let you tell us what you see?
Well, actually, it's timely because we were out to my cousin's place for dinner last evening, and my cousin is not experience in the markets, and he was asking about it, and I said, you know, this, for anyone who is interested in the financial markets, this is the most amazing time to be alive and upright and looking at it. I mean,
Bob, a lot of our listeners are bedridden.
This is remarkable stuff. It's a culmination. Guys who are not market historians, who have learned theories not based on market and are applying their theories to change financial history. Well, the first guy to come up with a statement that in the face of extreme tightness in the money markets, the guy by the name of Edward Misselden, and it was the crash that began in 1618. And it was a nasty crash. So he then rose, he wrote otherwise sensible papers on, you know, the philosophy of markets and stuff like that. But he did say, he looked at the hardship, looked at the tightness of money, and then said, well, if there was some age, something there to ease credit, then all would be well. So, gosh, and then you move ahead to 1710, on the way to the South Sea bubble and the Mississippi bubble. You had had a big, lengthy boom, inflation was high, and then it was over. And then you had high unemployment. And John Law then looks around and says, oh, money's tight. All would be well if there was an agency that could provide some extra lending power.
Here you have a fellow from Scotland whose father was a pretty well-to-do banker. He found himself in a duel. I believe it was over a lovely lass. And, of course, he won the duel, I guess if you can call it that. He barely escaped authorities. I think he was to be summarily executed the next day.
But he did hustle himself out of England. But he was also a mathematical wizard and a gambler. So
it's the gambling that really saved him, because I think he found his way, correct me if I'm wrong, to Amsterdam, found his way to Paris. That's where he really hit it off big. And the rest, as they say?
Yeah, he formed a bank of issue. And for a year or so, in good times, he made it work where people would prefer to have his paper banknotes than coinage. But at any rate, well, the theme is that people, intellectuals, I just generally call them intellectuals, look at the markets And particularly when you have a crash, which is natural to any excessive speculation, and they personally come up with this idea, oh, if there was money from somewhere, credit from somewhere, then we could make this unpleasantness go away. So John Law did it in 1710. Now then, the very esteemed editor at The Economist in London, in 1873, he published a book called Lombard Street. And in the book, he pointed out that whenever there was any contraction in the financial markets, which he called kind of a neuralgia, that it could be offset with immediate application of, of the central bank pumping money into the system. Now, 1873 was a remarkable year because that was the top of a bubble, a great financial bubble, and you went into it, a long bear market. So he published his book at the top of the market, and I'm sure that the Bank of England then, which was the senior central bank, did try and prevent the contraction, but it was nasty, and after some very weak business cycles, economists in England looked at the contraction, and they in 1884, they looked at it and said, "Oh, this is a Great Depression." And then you went on. That contraction ended as the business recession of 1895 completed, and then it turned around, and you went into a lengthy dynamic expansion. But academic economists like even Rostow, as late as 1939, were writing papers on how the Great Depression could have been prevented or ameliorated and made not as nasty, meaning the Great Depression of 1873 to 1895. And they were going on about this in 1939. And then all of a sudden they looked around and said, oh, we've got a Great Depression. So if you take the history of markets and the history of what intellectuals say on those markets, it provides an irony like you wouldn't believe. Because each one of these things, these guys thought they'd come up with an original thought. To 1929, the bubble, Keynes had been a reasonably good trader, was making money for his own account and also for the treasury of, I think, Cambridge or whatever university he had been at. And in 1929, he got blindsided and it hit him. And I like to say that that in 1929, Keynes took a bath and then invented the liquidity preference. Later on, Hayek then said about Keynes that when he was working on his theories, he knew nothing of economic history or what previous economists had written and all that sort of stuff. So here you had Keynes in the early 1930s coming up with the same theory that Meselden did in 1618.
Much of mathematics that was discovered by Leibniz and so many of the greats, Gauss and others, Leonard Euler, the Bernoulli family, as well as so many of the Italian mathematicians, much of their work was really rediscovered in English-speaking countries later on, and rarely did they get the credit for the work. It's a common theme, yeah.
And they think, okay, now, yeah, it would be a good idea in the face of a nasty credit contraction, if credit could come somewhere, from somewhere, and make the nasty go away. What, of all the various economic theories or practicalities that exist, why did Keynes's theories come to prominence? Well, because it enhanced the power and the wealth of the state.
We do have to tip our hat a bit to John Maynard Keynes, because for all of his failings and peccadilloes, which were many, eccentric, I think is putting it euphemistically, but regardless of all that, he did do some phenomenal work, and I think you'd agree that one of his best characteristics was he could encapsulate and quantify data on a macro scale, which really set the stage for our macroeconomic work here in the United States. That's the first thing I would add. And secondly, I'd add with John Maynard Keynes that I really respect him, that following following World War II, he said, let's not have a World War III with these people. We're going to have to treat them, you know, with a modicum of respect because we are slightly culpable for this Second World War.
Treaty of Versailles, but nonetheless, but Henry Hazlitt said of Keynes's theories, he was able to put the plea for inflation in arithmetical terms. You know, you look at it, that's brilliant. Oh, yeah, we're going to change fiscal policy to offset this, and we're going to change monetary policy to offset this, and dream world stuff, because how would you expect a committee to act coherently and actually arrange such that we're going to have a, we're going to, oh no, it's nonsense. Now, here's the point, that they're still applying it. If you read back Jekyll Island book about the guys who were promoting the start of the Fed.
G. Edward Griffin, yeah, well, he's been a good friend of the show.
In the early 1900s, they had this idea. When you had a setback in the financial markets, it was followed by a recession. So their thesis was that with the new central bank, you could prevent the financial setbacks, therefore you wouldn't have recessions. Now, since the Fed opened its door in January 1914, there's been 19 recessions.
The whole Fed concept, of course, was rushed through Congress, memory serves, Christmas Eve 1913. I think it was eventually ratified, as you say, either 14 or 15. And since then, we've had 100 years of tyranny. But what's interesting is, you know, my humble little tone, Waltzek Wealth Building Strategies, I really tried to outline a quick little overview. This is a theme that had been running for the United States starting way back in the 1700s. It culminated with the War of 1812, which, as you know, ended with 1814. Really only because Napoleon was irritating the British Empire at the time and because we received a 250, I want to say million, but it might be billion livre advance from the King of France at the time. This banker war, it's been going on for several hundred years.
Oh, yeah, because it's always intuitive that if somebody does this in the financial markets, you'll get that. But the main thing here now is that their idea of, now, here's the two flaws in economic theory and practice. One is they assume a national economy. That is absurd, especially here in Canada, where these guys think we got a national economy.
Canada is a fascinating, robust economy. It has one of the most liberal and, I think, brilliant banking systems in the world.
The banking system goes back to early 1800s, when Montreal was the financial center, and the law was that if you, any director of a bank in Canada then that was being formed, you were liable for twice the equity you had in the bank, personally liable. So this is how we ended up with a sound banking system. And I've often said that the best thing you can say for the Canadian banking system is that it wasn't designed by the U.S. Congress.
You're going to make a lot of people chuckle there.
Weakened over the last, I don't know, 30 years. Five big banks were outstanding, but it became politically popular to put in a deposit insurance scheme, which is not needed and was not needed, but then it allows for other smaller reckless banks to come in and play. So, but anyway, that's off course here, because what we're talking about is, how long will it take before the markets entirely reject the theories of interventionist economics? Now, the other failure point on intervention is that they've looked at history and they see that on each business expansion, on the normal business cycle, you get a credit expansion. So they take a look at two things that are correlated and claim causation. So here's where they then say, we're going to expand credit, and that's going to result in a business expansion. But we're seeing now, in this post-bubble contraction, that even they are frustrated, knowing that it's not working. So this is where they now don't like cash. They don't want people to use cash. But in the 1930s, there were officially sponsored anti-hoarding movements going on in the States. So I'm trying to say, Chris, is that we're coming to the end of a 100-year experiment in interventionist economics based upon nonsensical conclusions, very intuitive conclusions. So my thinking is that central bank, the Federal Reserve, really needs asset prices to be going up in order to get its portion of a credit expansion out the window. So they need speculators to bid up asset prices.
But they spooked the markets last week. We had two major Fed chiefs announce last week you can count on a rate hike, probably not by June, but it's looking very likely by July or the August-September time frame on the FOMC benchmark lending rate. Could be a long-term plus because it means economic growth is so strong, we're putting the brakes on.
They're trying to look after their own posterity. And all the way through the last few years, there's been Dudley and a few of these others, Fisher, have been trying to utter responsible statements, but they can't. It's not effective because the whole system of central banking is absurd. So we want to look at asset classes coming down. Now, 2015 in June, what was the Shanghai speculation blew out, and you got an honest index on residential real estate in Hong Kong. It peaked in August, and it's down something like 15% since. Then you've got now recently, in the last few weeks, headlines on high-end Manhattan real estate. It's suddenly, the bids for there are disappearing because the supply is coming on very strong. I think the only place in the world where property is still going up is Vancouver, but who knows how long that'll last. So my case is that when you get enough asset prices going down, it dismantles the ability of the Fed to pump out credit. And you're going to be into a credit contraction. But the beauty of this one will be is that the average citizen will look at all the stories about QE and da-da-da-da-da-da and say, hey, you guys, we're risking our tax money. The street and the markets and the public will find a way to limit the ambition of the Fed. But that's the story. That's another essay. But, you know, the thing is that you can have now other asset prices that flew. And now here's the theory, is that they were pumping out credit, became very serious in May and June of 2007, when first of all Bear Stearns had a problem. That was in June. And they've been pumping out, and you still had a crash. Senior index in the U.S. fell 50%. But if you step back to the 1929 crash, when London was the senior market, their main index fell 50%. So we had the crash. And then you're on the first business cycle and the first bull market out of a very classic crash. Stock market peaked in May a year ago. And if you use the NYSE comp, NYIA, it's in a bear market. And the Dow theory is still saying it's a bear market. And so you have no asset inflation there. Junk bonds got killed from June 2015 down into January. They've had a nice rally. Somewhere in here they roll over again. So there's another asset class going down. And then you've also got the art market, high-end art market, stalled out somewhere in August, September, and they're no longer the bids for that, as you would expect. So the thing now is what we're watching for is asset prices not going up and then asset prices going down seriously, and that marks the end of the great experiment by central bankers. So I mentioned that in the financial markets, it was very exciting to be watching or participating. But then on this side, in the policy land, the policy realm, it's very fascinating as well because we're coming to the end of an experiment that has run for 100 years now.
I'd like to shift gears, if we could, just for a moment over to an indicator. Essentially, I'm going to keep it as simple as possible. It's the implied volatility of the gold ETF contract, the strike price 10% above. So let's just say, 10% above. Let's say the contract is 120. You look at that contract and you compare the implied volatility of the 10% below that contract. And when you're in a bull market, as you might expect, the higher strike volatility tends to be slightly higher, and vice versa. when the market is in a downtrend. And it's quite an interesting forward indicator because GLD, the implied volatility, it remains high, despite the fact we've had a big move. And that would seem to indicate we are in still maybe the mid to early stages of a bull run. Tell me if your work confirms that.
Oh, yeah. Our study we did in November was that for the precious metal sector, and we emphasized gold stocks, that as it bottomed going into January, that would likely be the start of a cyclical bull market for gold stocks. And the explosive move out since then confirms that. So now we look at gold in a different way. My colleague is very good on charting and technical work on most anything, including gold. And I work on the historical, whereby in every post-bubble contraction since so way back, the real price of gold goes up, which then improves the operating margins for a gold mine. It also improves the valuation of a yet-to-be mine, you know, an ore deposit. That's what drives gold stocks to become the premier industry in a post-bubble contraction. And it's consistent. And as a matter of fact, even back in the 1600s, if there was a gold rush in Brazil, the Preto Ouro one, and it was 1688, I think, which was the bottom of one of these long contractions. And each, except for the Depression bottom in 1946, the Second World War prevented or distracted from a potential great gold rush. And the mechanism of gold rush is you had 20 years of an increasing real price and 20 years of discouraging employment in the rest of the world, industry and commerce. So men go out and look for gold. So you got the real price going up. Now, the real price has been going up relative to commodities for the last few years, and particularly crude oil. And you know that crude oil represents energy prices. And the gold miners are now beginning to see that this is good stuff. So then also you've had extreme weakness in base metal prices. The base metal stocks fell to a quarter of their high. So there's now, labor wage rates in mining are being held back because of the contraction in the base metal side. Now, that's the same as in any previous post-bubble depression. That's the way it works. The real price of gold goes up. The real price of base metals go down. And, Chris, you know, I think it's a plot by Mother Nature, because on each of the financial bubbles, and let's call what's going on now a secondary bubble because the main one is that the financial markets expand the normal instruments of credit. It also will invent new instruments of credit. So then when the asset prices come down and credit can no longer be serviced, then you end up in this terrible credit contraction. But Mother Nature knows how to improve the liquidity. She raises the real price of gold. Miners mine more of it, and despite all the Keynesians out there, the gold does get into the banking system and improves when the normal instruments of credit are shrinking. The new instruments of credit are just disappearing. So Mother Nature can't stand a vacuum. The liquidity crisis will come and go, and when they're in front, it'll be apparent. Intellectuals will look at the liquidity crisis and say, we've got to invent liquidity. Mother Nature will be raising the price of gold and will be actually increasing liquidity. I love the way it works. Back in the 80s, there was a fad in research. Financial research came around that was dealing with fractals in mathematics. So we took a look at it and I thought, oh, well, I don't see how that's going to help us. But there was one phrase that was useful, and it was constrained randomness. So what you look at is day to day, it looks random. But at the end of a 3 or 4 month period, you'll find you've got a seasonal change, like the seasonal low for crude oil in January. Then now we're looking for a seasonal high for crude oil in May. So there's the day-to-day is random, but you got those seasonal changes, which is a constraint. And then you got the business cycle one, the 3 to 4 year one, which then is another envelope of choice that's changing all the time. So that was the only practical thing, as far as I was concerned, that came out of Fractal.
Just happened to wander into an area that I like to speak extemporaneously on. And that happens to be chaos theory, because at the heart of chaos theory, of course, we find Fractal, and it really had a lot of its roots in Mandelbrot 69, quoted in my humble little dissertation I'm trying to get the committee to accept. You're discussing the whole topic that I'm working on. There's some neat avenues that come out of this. Firstly, I'll bet you've heard of this, pockets of probability. And here's a perfect example. When you see a pivot point in a weekly and a monthly chart and a daily, and they all happen at the same time, concurrently, you know more than likely, well, that's a top or a bottom, or what people call a hammer or a shooting star in the next week or two is going down or up. A pocket of probability. It's a little area where probability suddenly enters a chaotic, seemingly chaotic system. Another area that I love, autocorrelation or serial correlation, and this is just a fancy term we now call long memory in academia. Long memory, term for what we know colloquially as bull and bear markets. But we actually have determined it follows a mathematical construct known as hyperbolic decay. Instead of sounding like some academic, I can take it and I can bring it down to third grade level. And hyperbolic decay can be best illustrated by the dropping of a stone in a little pond of water. So you see a big splash at first, that's your hyperbolic. And then the decay, you notice how each subsequent ripple or concurrent ripple moves a little bit more slowly, but it's wider, similar to, you know, Kepler's laws of the ellipse around the sun. And the point simply is that hyperbolic decay represents non-randomness, the trend.
Remember when they did the work on it way back when about skewed growth curves? And this is the problem when you get into your hyperbolic thing. Another phrase for it is skewed growth curve. And when we looked at it in the 1970s, looked around, and there was no proof that a skewed curve could not be solved, but most people said it was impossible. But when you've seen one, you've seen them all. So if you take the day-to-day chart on the South Sea Bubble in 1720, and you can overlay it on, for example, Radio Corp of America, RCA stock in 1929, and then you can overlay it on, just grab one from 2000 and that bubble, Cisco, for example. They're all the same. And you're in a almost 300-year spread from the first one to anyone recently. And recently, the Canadian drug company, what was it, Valiant or something like that, did the same thing. So these are they're biological expression. And here's where, if you're using the normal tools of analysis, if you can, I remember I had some friends did it, they had a lot of computer time, and they had the top macroeconomic models of the day, and they plugged in all the numbers on economics they could on the 1929 boom. There was no formula, no mathematics, no equations that would anticipate the end of it. So the best of forecasting, macroeconomic forecasting models of the day didn't work. And of course, wouldn't expect them to work in a system that is a blow off, which is skewed growth curves. But what you do is when you get a skewed growth curve, you say, oh, what was the last one and what happened? You know what happened. So perhaps the latest rush up, the last rush up in junk bonds became unstable. Perhaps it was a skewed growth curve, and perhaps some of the wildest high-flying stocks recently got into that, from which you do
hyperbolic decay.
Hyperbolic, yeah, that was the term. Hyperbolic collapse. So I'm glad we're in agreement, Chris.
Do you know of any way that one could benefit from, let's say, comparing the implied volatility and the historical volatility? I've set up a chart here on my Thinkorswim platform. It took a little bit of tinkering, but I found a way to compare the implied volatility and historical volatility of any futures contract and any stock, not any options yet, but any futures contract, any stock. And what I've noticed is, when you see a spike up in implied, which is just expected volatility, you'd see volatility increase ahead of an earnings announcement, right, relative to its historical volatility, because people are anticipating, well, we don't know. Maybe earnings are going to be good. Maybe they're going to be bad. There's going to be a big move coming. It would seem to me that if you saw a spike up and a tight consolidation in the price, but a spike up in a really big spike in the implied probability with no major expected event coming, would that not be a forward indicator of a sharp move?
I think so. Now, my colleague Ross is a few weeks ago did something with volatility and implied volatility as an indicator on the stock market. I'll send it to you. And he mentioned afterwards that some academics got in touch with him and said something about, oh, I don't know what it was, but he said, well, look at, here's the divergence in VIX versus VIX further out or something or other.
The VVIX and the VIX.
He says that the divergence gives you the reversal. So, and this thing gave a reversal, suggesting a peaking, that this stock burst here would roll over, which it quietly is, I believe, rolling over. But it gave us a trade out of it. But being options and stuff like that, I just looked at it as an indicator rather than attempting to explain it or understand it. I just said, okay, we got an indicator, and I'll send it to you.
But what I put up for my Alpha Stock subscribers, and what I'd like for you all to do, just send me a message at gsr@hughes.net, GSR at Hughes. The spread between the higher strike and the lower strike on implied volatility remains extremely elevated. We haven't seen it in years, which would seem to me to be an interesting forward indicator that maybe as extended as prices look at these levels. I bet you've been looking at the weekly chart on the U.S. dollar. That put in a convincing bottom 3 or 4 weeks ago. I question whether or not that low is going to be taken out this year.
Well, we're bullish on the U.S. dollar. It came into, we've got a long-term chart on it of ups and downs numbered, and Ross is good at looking after that, and it's calling for a good move up in the dollar. And when you combine that with a seasonal high for a probable seasonal high for crude oil and a probable seasonal high for base metals around March or April, it makes sense that if they're going to go down seasonally, that the U.S. dollar would go up.
But don't you think, though, the CRB, if we bring the commodities, the broad-based index in, which I know is heavily weighted by crude oil, it sure looks as though it's put in a compelling bottom for the next 6 to 12 months. What are your thoughts there?
Oh, yeah, there is a bottom in there. On the way we're looking at it is on gold and silver got extremely overdone recently, going to correct. The base metals did a nice rally up, and you then had a late rally for the grains, and they can go down and test the dismal lows of January. That's what we're thinking.
How much of the 2016 explosive precious metals rally is due to the concurrent decline in the greenback?
You know, the gold stocks really moved, and I think that's because the big players in the industry in 2011 have finally written all that stuff off. And then underneath it, you've got the real price of gold moving up, which has got to be enhancing their operations. So I think the move in gold was of course, constructive.
Got to thank you for this impromptu interview. Wanted to get this information to our listeners today, some of whom are a little nervous by what they've seen, consolidation in the precious metals. I'm not convinced yet, at least, that this is the end of the 2016 rally in the precious metals. I see a really big potential for an explosive move in, believe it or not, the gold stocks.
We're in a cyclical bull market for gold. gold stocks.
I'm not saying you couldn't see a sharp retracement, but every time it gets knocked down, it's right there at support. It's building a consolidation, the type of consolidation that I've seen in the past that tends to culminate with a blow-off top. So I would like to see one last big push, another 20, 30% higher. Tell folks a little more about the services, please.
InstitutionalAdvisors.com. And because the name Bob Hoy is not a common one, you can just Google my name, Bob Hoy, and it gets you into the whole system. So we have Brian Ripley looks after inquiries, so that's the guy to get in touch with.
Absolutely. Bob Hoy, we thank you so much and look forward to talking to you soon.
Very good then, Chris.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves. Industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank, and founding director. Their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their RIA project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Gerald Celente, director of the Trends Research Institute. His team produces the Trends Journal with hard-hitting, in-depth analyses of the economic, social, political, and cultural trends. Welcome back, Gerald Celente.
Oh, thanks for having me back, Chris.
Thanks for joining us. And, you know, a lot going on in the yellow metal this year. It's been a solid year, so it's great to have you back. We know that you've been a aficionado for quite some time, and you like to add to the stockpile whenever you see discounts. Not as many discounts this year, and gold demand soaring, according to the World Gold Council. You've gone on record at your Trends Journal. You're watching the investment banks up the ante. They're expecting sharper moves and more strength this year, which is a big, I think, change of trend, if you will. You've also gone on record saying we could see $1,400 gold at some point and maybe even spikes much higher. Tell us more, please.
Well, as for 1400, what we're saying is that gold has to go to 1400. That means it has to find strength over the 1280 mark, move into 1300s, and then hit 1400, stabilize above that. And once it hits that, we believe that we can see a spike toward 2000. And we say that in consideration of what the realities are on the geopolitical and socioeconomic scene. So, for example, let's look at just what happened in Japan this week. This is the third largest economy in the world. They have negative interest rates. They've been pumping in trillions of yen since 2012 with their Abenomics scheme. And what were the results of imports and exports this past week? Well, exports were down 10%. Imports were down over 20%. People will say, well, exports were down because the yen was strong, and that makes their products more expensive to buy in the foreign markets. But if their yen is strong, then imports should have been up solidly. But yet they were down over 20%. What we're looking at is a global financial crisis. That's why I'm mentioning the third largest economy in the world. Take a look at what's going on in China. Despite trillions of yuan dumped into the markets, you're also seeing exports down and imports down. So then you look at what's going on around the world geopolitically. And as the Federal Reserve keeps threatening to raise interest rates, what happens to those emerging market currencies? They keep hitting new lows. I mean, you're looking at the peso, the bolivar, the South African rand to the ruble. Go around the world, the Norwegian krona. Every one of them, the higher the dollar, the higher the threat of a higher, richer dollar goes, the poorer those currencies become. Now, I'm mentioning that because we had all this quantitative easing, all that hot money that flowed out of the United States, the cheap money into these other markets, particularly the emerging markets, well, they have to pay it back in dollars. Now, they have to pay it back in dollars as their commodities prices that they're selling are going down and their currencies collapsing along with it. What does that mean? Well, they have to pay back their debt with more of their failing currencies. So now here's the question. If you lived in Brazil or if you lived in Venezuela, if you lived in Nigeria or you lived in Norway, any country, Canada or Australia, and you see your currency declining, what would you rather be in, declining currencies or gold?
You mentioned the land of the rising sun, and they've actually, Shinzo Abe, taken rates a bit negative there. Gold, on the other hand, just doesn't carry that risk. Guess you could make the argument that storing a large stockpile might entail a negative rate of interest because you have to pay for the storage. I guess if you really wanted to split hairs. But for the most part, there isn't that negative interest rate risk. Our central bankers are pushing on that proverbial string that economists like to call it. Efforts and monetary expenditures really give a decreasing return for their effort. And I guess that's really putting it nicely. What that means is our hard-earned money spent by our global bankers is not having the impact on our economy. Real jobs, real growth, real output, lower unemployment, stronger economic output and things of that nature. We're not seeing that. And so really, I think von Mises and Hayek, aren't they being vindicated by what's going on here today?
Well, of course they are. I mean, there's never been such a thing as negative interest rates. Why would anybody, 40% of the bonds being sold now are in the world markets are yielding negative rates. So you mean I'm going to loan you money and then when you pay me back and when the bond matures, you're going to give me less? I mean, you can't make this stuff up. And it hasn't worked. And when you're looking at the GDP growth of Europe, you look at the numbers coming out. They're soft. The PMI indexes, one after another, PMI index in the United States, soft. So what we're looking at is that despite all this quantitative easing, it's only enriched the rich. And that's not a throwaway line because 90% of the wealth 95% of the wealth created since 2009 in the United States has gone to the 1% because the cheap money, all it's done is inflated artificially the equity markets with $60 billion a month in stock buybacks. You're borrowing money for nothing. And they're pumping up their equities artificially because, and I say artificially, again, this is without dispute because you could look at four quarters in a row of 7% decline this last quarter in corporate profit.
I liken it to having a play, let's say a school play, and then paying everyone you know in your family to show up at the theater or in the audience. We have a full house. And of course, that's just artificial demand. And we know that artificial demand eventually has to wear out because they're going to run, their coffers are going to run out of funds, or they'll recognize, hey, wait a minute, this is not such a great opportunity for our shareholders anymore, i.e. our stock option, our cushy stock option bonuses. That eventually backfires, especially when they find that their colleagues are no longer buying back their shares and the music has proverbially stopped. You talk about Venezuela, and we've been mentioning this a lot on the show, and I think it's a really interesting petri dish, if you will. Venezuela is really one of the most vibrant economies in the world, or it was, and now suddenly we just erupt into this massive runaway inflation that has led to huge shortages. You know, you can't let Fifi or Fido out at night anymore. And people say, well, it can't happen here. My guess is you have different thoughts on that.
Well, it's happening here. When you mentioned before about we really had no job growth. And when we talk about the facts, what are we looking at? Half the population in the United States that's working is earning under $30,000 a year. I mean, that's no money to raise a family, to buy a house. That's why you're seeing first-time home buyers now under 30, 35 and under are at a 1999 low, because kids are getting out of school if they go to college. With now it's they're holding on to what, the debt. A new study came out and showed it's going to take you 15 and a half years to be able to put down 20% to buy a home. 15 and a half years. And if you don't go to college, you also, it's going to take you longer than that, put down enough money to buy a home. So there is no recovery here. The nation is deep in debt. And by the way, with the interest rates low, you know, you could keep the Ponzi scheme going a while. But what happens when interest rates go up and the government debt is so high? Well, now you're paying more interest on it, aren't you? So we face a crisis here, a social crisis, a socioeconomic crisis, and you could see it in the elections, by the way, why so many people are going to Sanders and Trump, because they're so dissatisfied with the two-party system. And Trump is really just a third-party candidate using the Republican Party as the shield for running. So when you look at both Sanders and Trump and you see the conditions of the United States and the, again, median household income, as we speak, is below 1999 levels. The gap between the rich and the poor is the widest of any of the developed nations.
You're exactly right. I mean, look at the middle class. It's not just shrinking. It's becoming an endangered species, right? I mean, we were looking in the 60, almost two-thirds of the United States was classified as middle class just a few decades ago. And fast forward to now, less than half in the mid-40s, let's say. And, of course, that's the backbone. That's the structure, the underpinning, you know, the foundation of a solid economy, vibrant economy. I mean, those are the folks who send their kids off to school and keep the cogs spinning and the machinery oiled, you know, within society. And it's what everybody tries to aspire to become and hopes that their family will be a little better off. And for generations, we were here. I mean, you could probably argue that you're doing considerably better than your parents. And that was just the norm, wasn't it, since the beginning of this nation?
And now you look at the data and people believe that they're not going to do as well as their parents. And again, that's new in society. It was always that each generation believed they were going to do better than the other generation. And so you can see the realities of what's going on. And then again, you have to overlay this as gold. It also has its geopolitical elements as being a safe haven currency. And that should not be overlooked, considering the Middle East is blown up. Look what's going on in Yemen. It doesn't make the news. The United States has now sent troops there to help the Saudis in their destruction of the poorest nation in the Middle East. You have the refugee crisis, but nobody wants to talk about how the refugee crisis became a refugee crisis. It couldn't be because the United States and its coalition of the killing, you know, slaughtered all these people in Iraq and Afghanistan, the most prosperous country in Africa, and created this refugee crisis. As geopolitics inflames, let's remember the Saudis invaded Yemen. A lot of the workers in the oil fields in Saudi Arabia are Yemenis. And now, right now, you're looking at government debt. Moody's just downgraded Saudi Arabia, as they did other nations in the Middle East, oil producing countries. So you're going to start seeing civil unrest, and you're going to start seeing regional wars break out in countries that we haven't seen them before. So gold becomes that safe haven commodity as there's more and more geopolitical unrest.
Is it relevant to the United States? You know, we've seen in the last few years considerable funds flowing in from the Eurozone, from, you know, nervous investors there, with also facing the threat of negative interest rates. Of course, then you've also mentioned on the other pond, if you will, over in the Pacific, huge investments, something like $4 trillion in disposable wealth there invested. It's one of the largest conglomerations of wealth, concentrated wealth in the world. You know, they obviously are facing negative rates. That, of course, is good for gold. Much of those funds have just simply, in this telecommuting world, in this interconnected world, flown into the domestic United States, which is also seen as a safe haven. You talked about gold as a safe haven, but, you know, the U.S. is still seen as a safe haven for wealth. Is there a theme? Is there an underlying trend there? Is there a current, a tide, that might change the way the world views the U.S.?
The way the world is going to change the view of the U.S. is because of its geopolitics. It's penchant for more and more war. As we said, you know, we're in the South China Sea, we're in the Baltic Sea, and there is a lot of anti-Americanism building around the world because of the United States military action. Having said that, it's still where you're going to go with your money if you have destabilization, as I mentioned, that you're seeing now in Europe. Look at the rise of the parties that are gaining so much strength over there. Whether it's the Alternative for Deutschland party, the AfD party. We just saw an election in Austria where the Freedom Party nearly won. But the new party that did win, the Green Party, is the first time a new party's won in Austria since World War II. You have Le Pen's party in France. You have UKIP in the UK. You have Podemos' party in Spain. So what I'm saying is you have a lot of unrest going on, destabilization, and America is still looked upon as that safe haven continent or country, I should say, where people are still going to go. And as you mentioned, the outflows of money are phenomenal in so many of these different places.
The spectacular equities rally we've seen in U.S. stocks and shares since 2009, where we had the credit crisis nadir. It's been a mostly solid rally since then, but of course, in the last year, things have become much more volatile. Considerable talk, I think, in the blogosphere that we could see a sharp sell-off. Do you buy any of that rhetoric? Will it be smooth sailing once we get past the November election?
So now look at the facts. And the facts are you're seeing great outflows out of the equity markets, over about $100 billion since the beginning of the year. Listen to people like Carl Icahn warning that you know, something's going to happen, it's not right, and others like Druckenmiller and saying you want some advice, get out of the market, and he's buying gold. So you're hearing it from Soros saying there's problems in China. You know, one after another, Zelle saying that you know, the market, the real estate market in the United States is it's overvalued. And he said, if you can't hear it, he said, I sell hearing. I'll get in the hearing aids business. You know, if you can't hear the bubble. And so no, it's an overvalued market for the reasons that I said. You're looking at corporate earnings down for the fourth quarter, and it was just down 7%. So, I mean, and so when you look at the P.E. ratios of the stocks, they're out of line. And again, the market has only been boosted, and the facts are there because of $60 billion a month worth of stock buybacks and merger and acquisition activity.
Shifting over to the real estate market, this is an important sector, not only as a component of our GDP and national product, but also to the typical American, you know, many of whom were burned back in 2007 to 2009. Obviously, we had over 10 million foreclosures in the U.S., and much of that, I think you'd agree, was avoidable. It was a train wreck headed our way. Do you see another potential potential scenario. Obviously, we don't have the subprime buildup that we had last time, but now it seems like with virtually every loan, every mortgage guaranteed by Uncle Sam, that maybe we could be facing a different dilemma this time, and it might even be larger.
Well, let's look at the markets, the real estate market. The last time was the subprime. Now it's the post-prime, you could call it. The top of the markets have flattened out. Whether it's Singapore, whether it's London, whether it's New York City or Miami, one after another, the tops are going down. So we're looking at the markets are rotting from the top down. So we can see a crisis very, even greater actually than that of the panic of 2008 because of all of the artificial gains that were brought about through quantitative easing and zero interest rate policy. It's a Ponzi scheme. Whether it's Japan's with its Abenomics, whether it's China with dumping in trillions of dollars to boost the equity markets, the real estate markets, and keep people working in overproduction areas such as steel and aluminum and others. And look what's going on in Europe with negative interest rates. They increased the amount of stimulus, the buybacks, from 60 billion euros a month to 80 billion. And not only are they buying corporate government bonds, they're buying corporate bonds. So when this thing collapses, it's going to be a collapse we've never seen in the history of the world because there's never been anything like this before with negative interest rates, zero interest rate policy, and record low interest rates and stimulus.
How long can they keep the house of cards together, and how long can they keep the music playing?
You know, it's hard to tell, and that timing is the most difficult thing. I would have thought this would have ended 4 years ago. You know, how did I know they were going to come with QE and QE1, QE2, QE3 going on? Well, you know, they're talking about the Fed raising interest rates. Big deal. They're going to raise them another 25 basis points. That'll be twice in 10 years. So you don't know. They're making up games as they're going along. And when I say they're making up games, they don't know what they're doing. All you have to do is read the Fed minutes. They wait 5 years before they release them, so we forget about the decisions that they made. And most people don't read them after 5 years. You find out they didn't know what they're doing then, and they don't know what they're doing now. So what they're doing, again, who would have thought of negative interest rates?
A repeat of the same shenanigans over and over again, and now it's just on an epic scale. So then you think, you know, we could see a QE4, QE5.
Exactly.
The Fed's balance sheet, it remains stable. It hasn't really plunged all that much. And so they can talk about raising rates a modicum here, a modicum there. But it really doesn't amount to much when you continue buying up toxic mortgage-backed securities, CDOs, to prop up the economy from implosion that you see eventually on the horizon. You know, so many people do. So many of our great guests here, Dr. Lawrence Kotlikoff from Boston University, is just one of a host of many who concur with your thoughts. Of course, Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, a colleague of yours as well. But again, the big question mark is timing. So we have to be prepared, and you like preparing, with the yellow metal. Any other words of wisdom as we wrap up today?
Yes, what people really should do is really stay in touch with the news, but not the news that they're getting from the mainstream media because it's so slanted. And it's really important to view the world rather than viewing it through the eyes of your nation or your belief systems, because particularly what's going on the geopolitical front with the United States in the South China Sea, moving into the Baltic Sea, building missile defense systems in Romania, and watch what's going on in Ukraine, and particularly pay attention to what's going on in the Middle East, not to get so wrapped up in the presidential reality show and to move your mind out of the U.S. and go global.
Sage wisdom indeed. Gerald Celente, would you like to tell people more about the Trends Journal, please?
The Trends Journal is one of the ways you can do it. You can read history before it happens. We believe there's going to be a central bank explosion very shortly. Again, the timing is difficult. Nobody could predict the future. But the Trends Journal will put you ahead of the future, that's for sure. It's history before it happens. And you can get it by going to our website, trendsresearch.com, trendsresearch.com. And if you're in financial problems, have a little difficulties going on, we have a discount request page. We try to make it available to everyone.
Don't you expect them, though, to fight the economic implosion with every means possible? To this point, they've used every weapon in their arsenal to try to keep the inevitable from happening.
Well, it's hard to tell, but again, the more that they do, the more solid gold becomes, because they're just doing things to devalue their currency. So we'll go through a deflationary cycle in terms of the products, where prices will go down because there's too much supply and not enough demand, but it'll cost you more to buy them because of the devaluation of your currencies. So that's where you have your inflationary cycle, and that's why gold is still, you know, the gold standard. It's been around for, you know, 500 BC, I think, and so it's not going anywhere soon.
And then you don't really see a Michael Lewis Big Short style scenario where we have debt implosions around the world. I mean, they continue just to buy up all that toxic debt.
It's a central bank time bomb. It's ready to explode. And this time when it does explode, they will try to do things, but they've run out of games. Where are they going to go? Negative, negative interest rates? More quantitative, quantitative easing? So the more that they do, that's what I'm trying to say, is that it's not going to be effective, and it'll be bullish for gold, both short and long term.
Exactly. So it'll be QE squared and cubed, and we go exponential at some point, and that's when you're really going to want that financial insurance in the family's portfolio, because it will offset many other asset classes. Gerald Celente, we thank you so much, and we'll look forward to having you back on the show.
Thanks for having me, Chris. All the best.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves. Industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank, and founding director. Their São Jorge project is 100% owned, with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Ria project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Hey Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. An insightful, thought-provoking infographic put out by BullionStar.com this week visually illustrates the enormous amount of gold traded on an annual basis on the London gold market. In 2015, 88.03%, or 1,355,400 tons of gold, were traded on the London gold market. That is both a staggering and unbelievable amount of gold, especially when you consider the daily trading volume in London is 5,500 tons of gold, and globally only 9 tons of gold are mined daily. And historically, all the gold ever mined totals approximately 187,000 tons. Yet London managed to trade 1,355,400 tons of gold in 2015. Sounds like a pretty good magic trick. So how did they do it? The gold they traded was fractionally reserved paper-traded gold. In other words, the gold had no legal title. It was unallocated and part of a massive paper gold system. In other words, a closed-loop Ponzi scheme with a limited number of major players and no real market-based price discovery mechanism. The one metric that was not included on the infographic was the value of the gold traded in 2015 on the London gold market. When you run that calculation, it will alarm you. There are 32,150 troy ounces of gold in one metric ton of gold. When you multiply 32,150 by 1,355,400 tons, you get a staggering 43,576,110,000 ounces of gold. When you multiply that number by $1,200 an ounce, you get a value in excess of $52 trillion worth of gold that was traded on the London market in 2015. That's pretty amazing, because the global gross domestic product in 2014 was just over $78 trillion in nominal terms. And this supposedly tiny, inconsequential gold market that, according to Ben Bernanke, is participated in by the Fed, supposedly out of tradition, isn't supposed to have any real relevance in today's economy. Yet in 2015, over $52 trillion worth of gold, albeit paper gold, was traded on the London market. When $52 trillion worth of anything is traded anywhere for any reason, it matters. Who's trading it? For whose accounts? Why and for how much? Transparency should not be difficult to achieve, but it has been, and it will continue to be. Because cries for transparency are one of the repetitive sounds from election cycle to election cycle. People forget they demanded transparency last time, and then they forget that they forgot. But if something becomes important enough again, it may crop up on the radar screen, only to compete and find its priority with the current ensemble of unmet election year needs. And as interesting and important as the machinations of trading $52 trillion worth of gold is to the world economy, because so few own gold, and even fewer understand the gold market, it probably won't rank that high on anybody's list. Until the day it appears on the horizon like a black swan. And by that time, it will most likely already be too late. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves. Industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank, and founding director. Their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their RIA project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in south-central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice. We'll